You're listening to Einstein A Go-Go on 3RRR. I'm Dr. Shane, and my guest today is Captain Gene Cernan, NASA astronaut on Gemini 9A, Apollo 10, and commander of Apollo 17. Captain Cernan was the human being who last stepped on the moon in 1972. Also in the studio with me is Peter Aylward, president of the Space Association Australia. Captain Cernan, thank you very much for making the time to speak to us today, and I should say a belated happy birthday for last week.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure being here, and those birthdays are coming all too quick lately.
I can imagine. Now, we're very excited about your upcoming tour of Australia and the launch of the movie, The Last Man on the Moon, which is directed by Mark Craig. Can you give us a bit of an idea? What should audiences expect from this film?
Well, I don't want to give the movie away. My intent, hopefully... Well, can I back up just a little bit? I was really not supporting their approach. It took them a long while to Mark Craig and Mark Stewart to talk me into doing this. I couldn't figure out why anyone would want to be interested in a movie about me. And finally, they convinced me that it was worth doing. They both read my book by the same name. The book is a little different, although it takes the personal approach like the movie does. It's really not technological at all. And they both liked it, and finally I was convinced that it really wasn't a movie. It wasn't about me. It was about a young kid from any town, USA, maybe any town in the world, who had a dream going way back to World War II to fly airplanes off aircraft carriers, and that dream was actually... contagious, and it was about, put it this way, they convinced me it was a movie to inspire young people to dream, to do things they didn't think they could do. And once they got me on that path, I thought, well, you know, maybe I owe something to this next generation.
Look, I watched it on Friday night with my wife. It's a fabulous film, and it's not just young people who are inspired to dream with this film either. I was quite inspired by it. Give us an idea of how long it took to put together, because, as you said, this is not a technical film. It is a deeply personal film, and I have to say, having watched it, I feel as though I, in a way, know you now.
Well, you're awful kind with your words, and that was the intent, quite honestly, because, you know, we weren't Superman who came out of the golden sky with a big silver cape. We're just normal people, put our pants on one leg at a time, and I think people needed to understand who we were, what we were, what we believed in. We have families, we have kids, we grew up from... you know, different means, and you know, my parents, quite frankly, were very blue collar, but I never was wanting for anything. Came from immigrant grandparents, and grew up in a big city, and my dream, which was, as I say, to fly airplanes, was stimulated by those unsung heroes in World War II. We didn't have television, and I know young people find it difficult to understand that, but we got the news in black and white film at the movie theater about once a week, and those unsung heroes of World War II, the Battle of Midway, those guys, they inspired me to do what I knew I never would be able to do, because that dream was completely out of reach for me at that point in time. But you know what? It happened, and here I am. And why can't it be every young kid in the world if they really want to do something badly enough?
It's good advice. Now, give us an idea, Captain, why you decided to do this now. Because, as you said, it's been quite some years since you put the book out, but you brought the film out now. What took so long for this to sort of come about?
Well, Mark Craig, the director, came to me about, it's his idea. It took a long time for me to get the book out, too. It took about 25 years until someone convinced me that the things they've been hearing me say ought to be read or heard by other people. And then Mark came to me about, it's been probably 7-8 years ago, with the idea. And I, You know, I've been sold a lot of swamps in the desert in my lifetime, and I figured I don't need another one. But he stayed with it. He stayed with it. He got Mark Stewart. Mark read the book. Mark was passionate about what he read, and he said, we not only can do this, we have to do it. And so maybe about 3 or 4 years ago, I agreed, okay, let's give it a try. And what's interesting, I had never done this before. I didn't really have any idea how they were going to put this together. Nothing, absolutely nothing was scripted. They took me almost every place conceivable in my background in the country and put a microphone on me and said, think out loud. And if you saw the movie, I guess Arlington is a pretty good place, a pretty good example of that. You know, you start letting your mind wander and go back, and here I was looking at the headstones of Roger Chaffee, my neighbor. My daughter played with his kids, dear friends of ours. We went hunting together. There's Gus Grissom. I saw Charlie Bassett's grave, and I kept thinking, why me? Why are they there, and I'm here? I don't have an answer to that question. I can probably go back to the days I actually got selected for the program and ask the same question. Why me? I didn't even apply for the program. I didn't meet all NASA's qualifications, and yet somehow I ended up getting selected and took that weavy path down the road, and fate, F-A-T-E, had a tremendous amount to do with how and where I got where I did. And, you know, and that was maybe the last 2, 3, 4 years, and we talked a little bit about it. We started filming, and I think the first realization of what the film was going to be like when they had about 4 hours in the can, and they said, you want to see what we got? And I said, well, yeah, I do. And it blew me away, quite frankly, and I still, at that point in time, had a tough time wondering how and why people were going to like it. But I tell you, to my, it's amazing. People all over the country, all over the world. We've been in the UK. We've been in a few other, Canada, and people seem to love it. And if they do, then I'm for it. Maybe I've got a legacy to leave before it's all over.
Captain Turner, it's Peter here. I too saw the movie in preview, and I was absolutely blown away by the photography and the images that were in there. Just want to ask you a quick question. The film is a very personal story from your perspective. What, in your opinion, is the most important and meaningful thing to come out of human spaceflight as opposed to unmanned spaceflight, and more specifically from the Apollo program, in your opinion?
Well, you know, we can talk about all the technological spin-offs. They're certainly important, but the technology of Apollo, and we couldn't have done it, you know, at that point in time without people literally creating the technology that we needed. When the president said, we're going to go to the moon back in 1961, I don't think many people, including yours, truly believed it could be done. We didn't know beans about getting to the moon. We had a lot of learning to do, and we certainly made our measure of mistakes along the way. And it cost us, without question, it cost us. But when you look back, the technology of Apollo is, I think, is already obsolete, overshadowed by time. These young kids have got more technology, more memory in their iPhones than I had in both of my hands when I landed on the moon. And so, and the questions people ask all the time are really, how did it feel? What did it look like? Were you scared? Did you feel you wouldn't come home? What do you do when you don't, you know, when you're not out on the road? What's your family like? And on and on, but they were all questions. I like to compare it if, you know, if you had Neil Armstrong and Christopher Columbus in the same room at the same time right now, I really believed you'd ask them both the same questions. How did you feel? Did you think you wouldn't get back? Did you think you'd sail off the flat Earth? How did you feel when you first stepped on a moon or saw land? Those are the things people want to know. And when you look back, what do I think the most important thing is? I guess we're getting right back to where we started. It's the inspiration of people, and you said it earlier, not just young people, but young and old, to do what they didn't believe was possible. We had the whole world believing we could do it after we got after it for a few years. People got on board, and I guess I was one of those guys once I got selected for the program. And you get involved, and you believe it. You don't believe you can't do it. You know, it's that kind of thing. And the next thing you know, you're standing on a moon and you've done it. Mm. And it still seems unreal. It still seems magical. It still seems to some degree like it's a dream, you know, some kind of science fiction dream. And you find yourself in this unbelievable place and you pinch yourself, am I really here at this moment in space and time and history? And the fact of life is, it's real. You've done it. And if I can do it, if I can do it, there's no reason every young boy, every young girl, every young man, every young woman in the world can't do something like this. And as a matter of fact, we owe it to future generations to explore. Mm. We literally owe it to open the doors to the future. Because, you know, otherwise you wither and die. If you don't grow as humanity, where do you go? What happens?
Mm. Captain Cernan, it's interesting. You speak so much in many of your interviews about inspiring the young and so forth. So one of the things I did midweek was I contacted a very dedicated elementary school primary school teacher that I know of here in Melbourne, and I asked her to challenge her class of grade 3 students. So these are 7 and 8 year olds. To come up with a couple of questions for you, because I thought it would be good for you to hear from them. So this is the group from Taylor's Lakes Primary School in Miss Emma Herbert's class, 3EH, and I asked them for two or three questions, and they gave me a list of 25, so I've picked out a couple for you.
See what I mean?
Yeah, they love it. Well,
the excitement and the interest in young kids, and it's really not hard to create that passion, that inspiration in their hearts and minds. They're ready. This future generation is much a part of what we did as we were at the time, and they can do it again.
Indeed, and they actually they got a little bit of an Apollo lesson before coming up with these questions, which I think is great. And their first question that I've selected was, when you were in space, was it extremely dark?
Dark?
Yeah.
Oh, no. As a matter of fact, yes and no. You know, there's a lot of paradoxes when you go to the moon. We were in daylight the whole time. You used the word dark. I used the word blackness. Darkness is when you're in a shadow, in our case, here on Earth or on the moon, of the sun. That's darkness. When you're in the shadow, and we were in sunlight, we launched at darkness from the Earth on Apollo 17, and that was because of where we were landing, but soon we came into sunlight, and once we left the Earth, we were in sunlight all the way to the moon until we came into the shadow of the moon. We got the moon between the sun and us, and we were then in darkness. But when you look back at the Earth and you look through that sunshine, and this is the paradox, and you look through that sunshine, and there's nothing for the sun to shine on except maybe the Earth itself, the multicolor blues of the oceans and whites of the snow and the cloud. And everywhere else along, you could look just a skosh alongside the Earth, and you are peering into the deepest blackness that you can conceive in your mind. I didn't say darkness. You're looking through sunlight and you're peering at a three-dimensional blackness. call it the endlessness of space and the endlessness of time. There's nothing there. There's nothing for the sun to shine on. So it is totally black.
Now, the other question they had for you was, how big were the craters on the moon? I think a lot of people have the wrong impression of just the size of things on the moon.
What size would you like? There's craters the size of football fields. There's craters probably the size, I won't say quite maybe the size of continents, but maybe pretty close. We landed in a valley that had mountains on three sides higher than a Grand Canyon is deep, to give you some idea. Now, the other side of that coin is when you're in the lunar rover, and you're in 1/6 gravity and you're driving and you hit a crater, maybe a crater the size of 3 or 4 feet wide, you're up in the air again. So you've got small craters, little potholes, and big, gigantic, what you'd recall, maybe have to call valleys, because they're almost not recognizable as craters because they're so big.
Mm. Now, question with regards to the time that's passed and so forth, Captain Cern. It's been almost 45 years since you walked on the moon, and at the time it seemed as though Kennedy, as you said, said it's an impossible goal. Do we have a similar sort of goal today, or have we lost something?
Well, I don't think we've lost the enthusiasm, and I don't think we've lost the will and desire of most people, particularly young people. And the program here in the States has always been, it's been a bipartisan program since the days of Sputnik and Gagarin, and certainly from the first flight of Al Shepard. And it is today. Neil Armstrong, Jim Lovell, and I had testified 3 different times in front of Congress, and I can promise you, those ladies and gentlemen are just as excited as most other peoples over what we've done, even though they may have been not born in some cases or young school children at the time. So it's a very bipartisan attitude. The problem is, just like everything else, we need leadership. We need a Kennedy. We need someone who's bold. We need someone who can challenge the nation. Oh, I know it costs money, and if you don't have the money, you can't do it. Well, it's not so much money you have, it's how you spend it. I'm not sure, and I can't even think back that far right now, what our budgets were back in 61 when Kennedy said we're going to go to the moon. But he found his world in the 60s, this country, let me put it that way. He found his country in sad shape. We were at campus unrest, civil stripes, burning West Los Angeles down. We were at the beginning of what became a very, very unpopular war. The Russians owned space. They put Sputnik, Gagarin, and they could put the grand piano in space if they wanted to. And we were left with little or nothing, because our vehicles, our satellites, our spaceships were falling into the ocean off of Cape Kennedy. It was a sad state of, I call it the terrible 60s. Most people today in the 40s and 50s don't really remember that, because they were too young or life was moving too fast as a teenager. They didn't pay much attention to it. But Kennedy, whether he was a visionary, bold visionary, a dreamer, politically astute, he indeed was bold, and he saw this country needed something. And here's two things to think about. By the end of that decade, 1968, we not only did the impossible, we orbited 3 human beings around the moon in 1968 on Christmas Eve. That was the answer to his bold challenge, the beginning of the answer to his bold challenge. And, you know, without that kind of leadership, without someone who's willing to be accountable, without someone who's willing to be responsible for what's important to them, we're never going to do it again. Now, having said that, will we do it again? Yes, we will go back to the moon. We will go to Mars. We had a program to do that 7-8 years ago, which was canceled by the present administration. And it's a sad state of affairs, because literally we could be on our way right now.
Yeah, Gene, back to Peter. I just want to go back to your film, if I may. In the film, we learn something about you that I believe that you did something no other astronaut had ever done in declining a seat to be on Apollo 16 to walk on the moon. Could you tell us about that?
That's the biggest risk I ever took in a space program, maybe in my life, as far as, you know, turning down an opportunity like that. Yeah, I had flown Gemini 9. I flew Apollo 10. I was back up on an earlier Apollo flight. I backed up Alan Shepard in a command seat on Apollo 14. Why I had the courage to do that, I'll never know. But you're right. I had an opportunity to fly on the moon, actually a flight before Apollo 17, but it would have been from the right seat. Why was that important? And my boss couldn't believe it. Deke Slayton said, "You're turning down," and he never really guaranteed anything, but he almost did this time. "You're turning down a chance to walk on the moon for a flight in the left seat, for a seat as a commander of a spacecraft for a flight that may never come about. Or if it does, you may not be selected to sit in that seat." And I told him yes, and I tell you why. It's not that I felt that I was better than anybody else. It's not that I felt that I earned it more than anybody else. But I had to prove, given a chance, I had to prove to myself that I was good enough to do it, that I was good enough to command a flight and be successful that landed on the moon. You know, I'd been an underdog. As I said earlier, I didn't apply for the program only because I didn't meet all their qualifications, flight time and test pilot school. And I had to prove something to myself. Given a chance, I had to prove something. Not to you, but to myself. And when I stepped on the moon, the first steps had already been taken, but those were my steps, and nobody could take them away from me at that point in time, or even today. And it was then that I proved to myself I can do it, and I did. And don't ask me. I mean, it was a risky decision on my part, because, you know, I've always said fate has a big hand in where you end up in this world, and it sure did on this occasion. I thought I'd almost ripped my knickers and never would fly again.
It's a fascinating insight into you as a person, Captain Cerner. So how long between you declining that seat on Apollo 16 and being appointed for the commander role of Apollo 17 was it? That must have been a very stressful, lie awake at night type of period for you.
Well, you know, even when I got the assignment as backup commander on Apollo 14, I had absolutely no assurances of any kind that I'd fly an Apollo flight again, much less be in a left seat on Apollo 17. I go back to the why me, and I said this in my book, and I don't take it back. I said, if I were my boss, and I was competing against Dick Gordon, a highly qualified, good friend of mine, highly qualified guy, could have been commander of Apollo 17. Plus, it was decreed that we had one lunar geologist in the program, and he was on the on Dick Gordon's backup crew for 15, and he was going to fly. Wow. There was no doubt he was going to fly. We knew it, and why would you break up a crew like Dick did and fly me and Ron Evans and put Jack on our crew? I don't know. Why me? I don't know. But I don't know. I just thank God that he made that decision. I don't know what stirred him on to do it, but you go out and do it. My dad always used to say, just go out and do your best and someday you're going to surprise yourself. He was right.
That's fantastic.
He was right.
Good advice. Now, Captain, there's a lot of activity at the moment with regards to the International Space Station, but I wanted to ask you a question that anyone who's been on board that station won't be able to answer, and that is, what is the real difference between the experience you get in sort of low Earth orbit and actually being in what we would refer to as, you know, deep space, outer space?
Two words: ex- expectation of space. In other words, we're going to take what we learn and we're going to exploit space to our advantage versus exploitation versus expanding our knowledge, exploration of space. And going back to the moon or going on to Mars or whatever, and what we did on Apollo 10 and 17 was the exploration of space. There's a tremendous difference. What we're doing on space station, we hope does benefit us someday, and I believe it will. But we're exploiting. We're exploiting the benefits of near-Earth orbit, the zero gravity, the vacuum, and near vacuum of space. And there's a tremendous difference going where man has never gone before, seeing what has never been seen with human eyes before. That's exploration of space. Mm.
Now, one other question I have for you here is with regards to, I guess, similar, related to a question you must always get, which is what was it like to be on the moon? But what I want to know is, what was it like when you actually came back? I mean, how were you changed?
Well, I'd like to believe I haven't, but undoubtedly I have in some way, one or another. When I went out to the moon on Apollo 10, and you watch the Earth recede to something as, you know, you can literally cover with the palm of your hand, and like Apollo 13, it could cover the Earth with your thumb. That's your real world, that's reality, that's where the past or future is. You look back at that Earth and it doesn't tumble through space. It moves with purpose and logic beyond your conception. It every 12 hours it rotates on an axis you can't see, but you know it must be there with order, and you're looking at the other side of the world. It just was too beautiful to have happened by accident. And to me, after I came back from Apollo 10, I I'm not talking religion, I'm talking about a spiritual difference between Earth orbit flight and going somewhere. And you come back and you never forget what you saw. Went back on Apollo 17, went one step further, went out of Earth orbit, down to the surface of the moon, and I think I said in the movie, and I've used the phrase quite often because it's the only way I can really explain it. Hopefully, if you use your imagination, you can find yourself there. I literally sat on God's front porch, looking back at the small piece of the universe which He created. So I came back without question, believing that this Earth, this world, this universe has a creator, a creator that is behind its making. Now, has that changed my life? Does that, quote, mean I have to go to church every day or every Sunday or whatever? I don't think so. But that image, that feeling, that thought, that knowledge, I can never undo.
Gene, we're just about out of time here. Thank you so much for your time. Just one question. You're on your way to Australia shortly. We're looking forward to seeing you and, of course, your movie. One thing that you probably are aware of is that Australia, back in the 60s and continuing to this day, has a fairly small but very critical role in the Deep Space Network. Were you, as part of your duties in your missions, aware of the Australian involvement at Honeysuckle Creek, at Tidmunbilla, at Carnarvon, and New Norcia in Australia?
Yeah.
And is there anything you'd like to say to the people that work there? Because there'll be a number of those people at your movies, I'm sure.
Let me tell you, we couldn't have done what we did without Australia. God put that creator put Australia in the right place. I love Australia. I'm really anxious to get back to the people back there. They're so wonderful. You are all as much a part of the space program as we were. I've always said we weren't in that spacecraft alone, and I believe it, because I think anyone who had anything to do with it, anyone who put a bolt in a heat shield, anyone who worked with us from the surface, from Perth or anywhere, was on that board, that spacecraft with us. I can remember one time on Gemini 9, I had a lot of trouble with my my workload, my heart rate. I overpowered the cooling system in the in a spacecraft. My visor became fogged. I was outside a spacecraft day and night, a couple revolutions around the Earth. And one time I knew I had to be over Australia. And I took my nose and I rubbed a little hole in the fog so I could see through the helmet, through the visor. And sure enough, there were the lights of Australia. And that gave me a level of comfort that you cannot, I don't know if you can relate to it or not, but it was significant to me.
Yeah, I can. Yeah.
Captain Sennon, as I mentioned, I did watch the movie on Friday with my wife, and of course she's the most important critic I can trust. And at the end of the movie, I just wanted to relay to you her comment. She just came out with a very short sentence, and she just said, "What a gorgeous man." So that's the effect I think the film will hopefully have on many people.
Oh, you're kind. I'd sure like to meet her.
I'm not sure I should allow that.
we hope you're kind. I do appreciate your words. I can't. I'm overwhelmed.
Yeah, look,
of the reception the movie's seen, but when you say those kind of words, it just blows me away. I just had no idea.
Well, we're absolutely blown away by the career that you've had, and I have to say it has been an absolute privilege and an honor for Peter and I to speak to you today, and we very, very much are looking forward to your visit in May this year to Australia.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to seeing you folks, we'll do what we have to do. We can talk about it. We can do whatever we need to do about it. But warm up the weather just a little bit for us.
We'll do our best, although that could be a little tricky. We're moving into winter. Thanks so much, and we will see you in a short time.
Okay, very good.
Safe travels. Thank you, Captain Sennon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.